In this episode of Startups the Rest of Us, Rob and I are going to be talking about a prioritization framework to deal with task overload. This is Startups the Rest of Us, episode 332. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us. The podcast helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products. Whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it, I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's going on this week, Rob?
You know, you reminded me that I haven't mentioned the conference that Drip is putting on. You know, it's via Lead Pages, but it's called Automated, and it's the first marketing automation conference that we know about. So we have automatedconference.com, and it is a virtual marketing automation conference, April 12th through 13th. So it's actually during, I think, is that MicroConf Starter Edition?
Yes, it's during MicroConf Starter Edition.
Right. So obviously I will be pre-recording my thing since it's virtual. It's nice to be able to do that. But if you're interested at all, it's free and there's a recording available after, but I think that actually costs money. If you watch it live, it's free. And a really good speaker lineup, you know, Ezra Firestone, Laura Roeder, obviously Clay Collins and Brennan Dunn, Anna from my team. And there's a lot of folks that are going to be dropping some mad knowledge on email marketing, marketing automation, and that kind of stuff. So check it out if you haven't. automatedconference.com.
I almost feel bad because I think I feel like I have to correct you here, but the website says that the recordings are free if you register by the 13th.
Oh, sorry. Thank you. I misread it. Yeah, it's funny. You know, it's a trip to, I mean, I'm not putting it on myself, right? We have a conference organizer, so I haven't even been heavily involved in the planning of it, but that's good. That's a good way to do it, is to give it away. I know. Thank you for correcting that, Mike. I appreciate it.
It almost feels awkward.
I know. Yeah, don't worry about it. I'm glad you did, because so that everyone listening doesn't feel like they have to pay for the recordings. So how about you? What's going on?
Well, I did want to say congratulations over to the guys over at Snappa. They wrote into us and said, hey, Mike and Rob, huge fans and longtime listener. A lot of the strategies discussed in your show helped us grow a startup to $25,000 in monthly recurring revenue in 16 months without raising any funding. Just wanted to say thanks and looking forward to MicroConf next month in Vegas.
It's pretty cool. Snappa.io, and their value prop is to create marketing graphics in a snap to whip up graphics for social media ads, blogs, and more without Photoshop or graphic design skills. So it's kind of like it looks like an in-browser editor, but completely designed to manipulate images and make them kind of marketing and ad worthy.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about that, and I saw this several months ago, was that they kind of aimed it at the people who are doing advertising on Twitter and Facebook, because all those things have image requirements that are slightly different from one another, and they make it easy to kind of do all the things that you need to do to make the images social media ready or, you know, ad ready. And it's really nice to just have a tool like that you can just log in and boom, you just make all those little tweaks and edits, and now you've got your images, as opposed to having to send them out to a designer and say, hey, I need 10 different variations of this, and figure out what the variations are that you need. It's like they kind of have it built in.
Seriously, I totally could have used this when I was running Facebook ads. I used to spend so much time in Pixelmator, which is what I use on Mac to edit, and it was just redundant work over and over and over. And then I eventually outsourced it, but it was always hard to keep a designer. All the designers I find who are good, they wind up taking jobs. They like don't stay freelance for, they either get really expensive or they take jobs. So I was always either trying to find someone for his tiny project or doing it myself. And I really could have used a tool like this. So congrats to Christopher Zimmer and the folks over at Snappa.io. So in terms of like Drip updates, we've hit our stride. We hired, frankly, he's a UX slash designer, and he also slices stuff into HTML. And he started it was several months ago now, probably 4 or 5 months ago, but he's really hitting stride with just cranking out front end stuff. And we've always had a really deep, you know, pool of Rails developers on our team. And so the kind of our limiting bottleneck has often been for new features has been front end work. And now that, you know, both Derek and I say he's the new guy, but he's been with us 4 or 5 months now. But now that he's really hitting his stride, it just feels like we're shipping something. I mean, I think we shipped 2 or 3 fairly substantial features just last week. And while we can't maintain that pace all the time, I do think that we're really hitting that stride of getting something meaningful out. And by meaningful, I don't just mean a checkbox or a little tweak to this or a little tweak to that, but an entire sequence of screens that does an entirely new flow. Like we added merge subscribers, where you can merge two drip subscribers into one. We added global UTM settings. So it's this several tabs of like doing something that then defaults to all of your links anytime you put them in an email. You know, as self-serve SPF DKIM, which is the way you can verify your own sending domain. And that's like six or seven screens deep and deals with the SendGrid API, you know. So there's a ton of stuff that we've been shipping. So that feels good. I mean, I realized Derek long ago told me, looked me in the eye and said, we are product people, like the dopamine rush is from shipping features. And if you don't ship features for a while, I start to forget that. And then having feature go out after feature, it reminds me of that's really why I'm in this, you know, is to get cool stuff out the door that customers are clamoring for. And then to hand that off to the marketing department and have them market and talk to support about it and have them say, oh, this is so cool. It's going to help our customer. You know, that it's like, it's a really good feeling. So I'm kind of feeling, especially the last few weeks, like just feeling up and, you know, and optimistic about things.
That's cool. I've actually used I stumbled across the merge and the UTM thing on my own when I was in there because I was automating my inbound lead funnel for Bluetick and found those settings. I was like, oh, awesome. And then I just like started using them already. I haven't seen the other one in terms of the DKIM stuff, but I did use the other ones when I stumbled across them. Speaking of that, I started automating my inbound lead funnel for Bluetick. So I changed my homepage to have this request an invite right on the homepage. That's kind of the main call to action. And once you submit that, it sends the email address over into Drip. And then there's a workflow there that will wait for about 10 minutes or so, because the next page after they do that is it takes them to a survey. And if they don't fill out the survey, then Drip will start sending them a couple of reminders to say, hey, you haven't filled this out. It'd really help us out. And really, that's essentially a pre-qualification mechanism for me. So I look at that, and when they submitted it, the form will remove them from that campaign in Drip and kind of put them into this sort of a holding area where when the form gets submitted, it goes to a Google spreadsheet and I look at it and I can just mark it as either qualified or unqualified. And if it's qualified, then it sends it over into Bluetick and Bluetick invites them to a demo, and then it creates a task and I can modify the text of the email that it gets sent to them based on what it is that they said to me inside of that survey. And I started using this a couple of weeks ago, and so far it's working really, really well, because I can actually show people who've gone through that and they get to a demo exactly kind of how they got there. And it's just dog fooding it like a second level, where I get to not only dog food it and use the product in a way that my customers would, but I show them how I use it, and I can show them their contact information and all the different touch points that they hit and why certain things happened. There was one guy who replied to an email and he signed up for a demo. It was like from an email that was sent at like 7 o'clock in the morning. And I surely did not send that email, but he saw it and said, oh yeah, I signed up for this and I filled out the survey and I didn't respond that first email, I should do this because you basically reminded me. But it wasn't me that actually sent it. It was Bluetick.
That's super cool, man. The dog fooding stuff we talked about a few weeks ago, but it's a big deal, A, to get this automated to save you time, but B, to be using your own product and to be able to demo it along, you know, during that process. So you kind of have the luxury of having a product that is demoable during the sales process to the people who'll be using it. So congratulations. Sounds cool.
Yeah, it's nice to be able to do that. And it's just interesting to see like the different reactions. And somebody had asked me about whether people frown upon seeing how the automation behind it is working and the fact that I'm not actually sending the emails. And so far, I haven't gotten any pushback. In fact, a lot of the people I've talked to have said, you know, I really like that you do this because it shows me what my customers are going to see. And even though I have in the back of my mind, I know that it is probably automated, it doesn't matter because it solves my problem.
Oh, I totally agree. If you were showing me that and I was your, you know, prospect, I would think that's genius. Like with the moment it you know, pulled the curtain back and kind of showed the Wizard of Oz standing back there, I'd be like, dang, that's it. I mean, I'm sold. I think it's a really cool way to demo it. So before we dive into our main topic for the day, I wanted to revisit our goals, kind of do a quick status update on the goals that we set back in December of 2016, because we're almost through the first quarter of 2017. And we haven't in the past kind of revisited them until a complete year later. And so this time I figured we'd just take like, you know, a couple of minutes and quickly go through the goals and see how we're making progress on those. So your first goal for 2017 was to log at least 100 days of exercise this coming year. And if you're on track to do that, then you would be what? Approaching 25 days of exercise.
Approaching 25.
Right.
Yeah, I'm probably at 15. something like that. So I'm definitely behind. You know, it's just not something I've been able to get to every single week. But, you know, there's definitely those times where it's not too hard to get to at least two or three a week. But, you know, then there's other times where stuff comes up and I have to deal with it and I just kind of fall off the rails for like a week or so at a time. But I'm a little behind. It's not outside of the realm of possibility for me to get it back up there, though. So I'm hoping to kind of play catch up a little bit. How about you? I think you had a similar goal of 2 days of exercise a week. How are you doing?
Yep. I am doing, I would say I am exactly on pace. There were weeks like when we went to Cancun in late January for 7 days and I exercised every day. So I had 7 straight days because it was just, you know, you just have a lot more time and it was gorgeous there. And so it was easy to get out and run. And then I've had a few weeks where I don't do anything, which is a bummer. I want it to be more consistent, like 2 days a week. But recently, you know, when we moved here, we have an elliptical. You know, I ran track for 9 years, I ran the hurdles and my right knee is a little messed up. So when I run on asphalt, it's actually kind of hard. I can do it, but yeah, I kind of pay the price for it. So we have an elliptical, which is like a, you know, it's a glider, right? So you don't have the impact. And that was busted for a while. And then I finally figured out how to fix it within the last month. And since then, I've been at least 2 days a week, between 2 and 3. And so I am currently feeling quite good about that. And frankly, I kind of need it to work off the old winter weight, the lack of getting out and even just doing basic kind of walking around, riding my bike to work and all that. I can tell it's starting to take a toll on me. So I want to definitely keep up the 2 days a week. And hopefully if it should be warm here in the next month or so to be able to start riding to work again. How about you on your next one?
So my second one was blogging publicly at least every 2 weeks. And that's a complete fail at this point. I've blogged once and I should be at least 4, I think. What's that? Is that about right?
No, 6.
No, 6. I should be at 6 by the end of the by the end of this month. So
do you want, is this a goal that's worth, because to me, this feels like a distraction. Like to me, your number one goal should be Blue Tick, getting cut, you know, 25 customers, getting to launch, all that stuff.
It is.
I know that this is a nice to have, but even when you said it in December, if you go listen to the episode, I was kind of like, why do you want to do this? You know, I get why, but like, do you really want to do this? So is this something that you think you're actually going to do? Or is this kind of a punt and it's basically replaced with your third goal, you know, that you're about to go into?
I think you're right. I think it should just kind of be replaced. And I mean, if I'm going to do any sort of blogging, it would be more content articles and things like that for Blue Tick. It wouldn't really be, you know, on my personal blog. So there's really not much point to me doing that stuff. I mean, you know, maybe it could lead to book sales or something like that, but that's really not like a major priority for me at this point. Really is the third thing on the list, which was making Blue Tick profitable. And that's sucking up almost all of my time at this point.
Cool. And we might as well just do your last one now. What's your third goal that's probably going to take precedent over this one?
Well, that is it. It's making Blue Tick profitable. And that's, I think that's going in the right direction. I mean, I've got people are signing on and demos are going well. I've got to start putting together my launch sequences and going out to my email list. But one of the things that I've been much more focused on lately is getting the product to the point where people can kind of self onboard and without having me to sit there and say, hey, this is what you need to do or walk them through it. And I had a meeting, I think yesterday, with somebody who I kind of brought on a temporary basis to do UI and UX consulting. I walked him through like an onboarding process and he looked at it and he said that, yeah, there's very obvious ways for you to improve this. So he's going to sit down and work out kind of what the priorities of those things are, because it's kind of difficult for me to understand what those priorities are because I've been so close to it for too long. So I really want that external opinion to say, this is what doesn't make sense. This is what is easy to understand without any additional explanation. And here's how we can go about approaching and tackling those problems. And this is the order that they should be done in.
Very cool. So my second goal was to have 1 to 3 angel investments or 1 to 3 new angel investments. And I have done 0 so far, but there is one company that is doing kind of a follow-on round, and I think I'm going to put more money into them. So given that, you know, the pace that I'm likely going to do these and that it is such a sidebar for me, I would kind of include that under the umbrella. Like if I do follow-on rounds, I know there's less due diligence and less work to be done, but I think putting more money to work in startups is my intent here. So I would say I'm on track to do one here in the next month or so, and then we'll see what the rest of the year brings. And then my third goal was to not start any new projects, you know, just to run the 3 microcomps we're running, the 2 podcasts, continue driving Drip forward and take a break from kind of the chaos of always starting new stuff. And the one exception to that was if Sherry decides to write a Zen Founder book, that I would be second author on that. And so far this year, due to health issues in her extended family, she has not begun that. But I do hope that, you know, I have hopes that in the latter half of the year that might get going. So far on track for that as well. I mean, this is kind of a non-goal, right? Like we discussed in December, it's to not take on any new ambitious stuff and just kind of let things settle. So I think that's about it. You want to dive into what we're chatting about today?
Sure. So today's episode, what we're going to be doing is we're going to go through essentially a prioritization framework to help deal with task overload. And I've started using this framework. This is based on Anthony Eden's blog post called Aligning Projects with Business Goals. And we'll link that up in the show notes. But Anthony is from DN Simple. And he had sketched this out inside of our private Founder Cafe community a couple of months ago, but he refined it since then, and he put out a blog post on it. And in this blog post, he talks about the fact that he's running this large team, and it's got a bunch of different people, and they were able to kind of keep track of all the different things that needed to happen and what their priorities were. But as the team grew and as different people's responsibilities changed, it became more difficult to prioritize things across the entire business. So he essentially developed this framework to figure out what should we be working on, what's the most important, what's really going to drive the bottom line for the business and help it stay in business and make them grow. And some of the basic problems that you're trying to really solve with a framework like this is the fact that, first one is that there's always more to do. If you look in any given bug tracker, for example, or any task management system, it feels to me like anything I've ever used, the number of tasks that are in there go up over time rather than down. You know, you think about these burn down charts, and those are great if you have like a sprint where the number of tasks is defined for a particular time frame, and it's going to go down. But in the background, there's always new things that are being added. So those things are just being added faster than you can clear them out. And it almost doesn't matter the size of your team, because as you add people, there's more that you want to accomplish and there's bigger things. But some of those things are not worth doing. And this helps you prioritize those things and really help clearly see what is and isn't worth doing.
Yeah, I agree with you on the kind of to-do list that there's always more work to do. That's where I think sprints can be helpful, because they do give you a sense of actually accomplishing something, right? You kind of limit the scope, you go for 2 weeks or a week, however long your sprints are. And then when you're done, you do cross this big thing off the list, and then you're able to reprioritize and attack new ones. I think the other thing that I do with both my to-do lists and with kind of our issue tracker in terms of drip is we are pretty guarded. I guess me personally, I'm very guarded about what actually goes on that to-do list. I don't just throw everything I think of on there. If I'm just brainstorming and thinking of notes of like, yeah, maybe I should do that, I put it in a notebook or I put it in a separate Trello board. Typically, it's in a notebook, to be honest, because unless I revisit it, unless it comes up again, unless I stumble upon it when I kind of flip through my notebook every now and again, and if I see it again and it's like, that's genius, I have to do it, then that goes on the to-do list. But I see people's to-do list sometimes and I'll ask them, like, why is that on there? And it's like, well, it was an idea I had. And it's like, well, then it's not a to-do, right? It's just an idea, like figure out a different place to put it. And same thing with feature requests. And, you know, you don't want like customer feature requests. You're getting five of them a day. You do not want those going into your issue tracker. That's not the place for them unless they're completely cordoned off, because otherwise it just fills it up with all this noise. And you're just going to have hundreds and hundreds and then thousands of feature requests or ideas or whatever. And you really want to have them in their kind of their own repo. And what should be in your issue tracker is stuff that is actually at least in the realm of possibility that it's going to be built.
It's interesting you say that, because I put customer requests in there. And then what I do is I put the customer's name as a tag on it. And then once it gets to what I look at as kind of a critical mass, like if I see enough people are asking for that particular thing, then I reprioritize it to say, hey, this is something that we're actually going to look at. But there's a lot of things in there that one person asked for it, or there was a question that came up for it. And it just kind of gets into this, I think we categorize it with a special category that just basically says that it's a customer request that we're probably not going to do any time in the near future unless we get a lot more people asking for it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Here's where that may start to break down is, as an example, a drip gets more than 100 feature requests a month from external people, and we get about 25 requests per month from internal. So we literally get, no joke, 125 at least feature requests per month. And you know, how many of those can you build? Five, maybe. So after 6 months, you know, you're going to have 720 things, and you don't want those in your main issue tracker, right? You want them off. They can still be in the same repository, but they should be off in a separate view that you'd never have to look through if you're actually trying to kind of, I shouldn't say never have to look through, that you don't have to look through every time you're trying to pull stuff up into the development queue. You can always, you know, you do want to review this queue, obviously, every month or every 3 months and kind of look through, because certain ones are just going to come up over and over. I found that trying to keep absolute exact count of these things is not helpful, that the ones that bubble up to the top are the ones that you just know it. Like gut feeling, you see, you hear the requests over and over, or you know that it's a really good idea and it's something that a lot of people will use.
Yeah, at my scale, like I don't have that problem yet, so.
Totally. Yeah.
But I mean, kind of more to the point here is like, there's never enough resources to do everything. And even as you add resources, it almost doesn't matter because the things that you want to do, you're still just not going to have enough resources to do them. And there's always these little things that get added, which somebody's got to look at it and evaluate it. And even if you decide to do it, it just gets added onto the list. So you need a way to prioritize these things. And that can be really challenging to identify what is the most important thing when there are so many things to get done. And even if you have this shorter list, it'll almost doesn't matter if you split it up into these are the critical things and these are the non-critical things. I remember seeing a Dilbert cartoon about that. It's like, you know, here's how to get everything done. Just create two lists, put all your critical stuff on one list, create all your non-critical stuff on the other list, do them both. And if you don't, you're a loser. But like, it's not possible to do everything. So having this framework allows you to establish some objectivity and remove your personal mental perceptions of the situation about what is important and what's really not, because it removes your own biases towards certain things. Let's say you just talk to a customer and they say, well, this is a problem. Your natural inclination is to weight that more importantly because of the fact that you literally just talked to that customer versus using a framework that allows you to create it to take a step back from that and objectively evaluate it.
Yeah, this is hard. I mean, especially, you know, as basically a product owner or a product manager, when you're, even if you don't call yourself that, if you're the founder, for the first while, definitely through product market fit and probably after, you're going to be, you know, a point person, a key player involved in deciding what gets done. And there's always, always 10 times more or 20 times more that needs to get done or that could get done than you can actually get done, right? It's like the, you know, the 100 feature requests, but you can build 5. So that's always going to be there. So then you have to figure out what is it that actually needs to get done. And there's a bunch of different approaches to this. And what we're talking about today, of course, is the framework that, you know, that Anthony Eden laid out in his post.
So let's start digging into this framework a little bit. And the idea of this framework is that you classify the different things that you're doing based on different criteria. So, and what this does is it gives you a basis for measurement that can be applied uniformly across all of the different tasks. So there's some things that he recommends, or it's really just a spreadsheet, and you have like the title and description of the things that you're working on. And then you put in different factors. So the first one is effort. And effort is essentially a broad measurement of how difficult or how time-consuming it's going to be to implement that. And with this framework, you can use it either on a feature-by-feature basis or on a project-by-project basis. You can have basically subtasks in there and add them up and say, well, this project is more important than that one. You know, maybe you do some averages in there. I think that might be a little bit more difficult just because of there's 50 tasks for one project and only 10 tasks for another. It might be difficult to just add them up as raw numbers, but you can see between those two projects, if one comes out with a score of, let's say, 25, and the other one comes out with a score of, the highest task comes out with a score of 10, the one that's 25 is clearly more important to do. So again, going back to that first one, effort is something you would put in as a column. And this is rated 1 through 3. It's small, medium, or large. The thing I really like about this is that it removes timings and time estimates associated with it. Small, medium, and large, you can look at that and ballpark any particular task. You don't have to be good at it either. That's the best part. It's like, because we're terrible at doing really good estimates. So if you say something's going to take you 2 hours, it might take 3, it might take 4. But is that considered small, medium, or large? And I would probably say small, because it's not a lot of effort. Medium to me would be like a couple of days, maybe a day or two. And then large would be at least a week, if not 2 or 3. What about you? Like, well, how would you kind of classify small, medium, and large?
I really like his approach here. I mean, I think, you know, in the old days as a consultant, we had to give quotes that were basically down to the hour, right? We'd have to say, this is going to take 6 hours to build that feature. And you just don't need to do that when you're building a product like this. So I like the idea of effort, 1, 2, and 3. And whether, you know, whether you make your small, medium, and large match exactly what Anthony's saying in this post, or whether, you know, given your time frames, those are different durations of time, I think it's really nice to keep it simple so that you don't want to put in so much time and analysis that this becomes cumbersome, right? You're taking your best guess at it, and having a 1, 2, or 3, it's a 5-second decision with almost all features. You're going to be able to slam it in, you know, in the bucket pretty easily.
The next one Anthony lays out is urgency. And this is essentially a raw estimate of the time sensitivity for something. So this is rated between 0 and 2. And 0 is no deadline. 1 is a deadline within the next 6 months. And then 2 is a deadline within the next 3 months. What I found a little bit odd about this was that the deadline within the next 3 months, there's nothing there that says this needs to be done right now. And I think that that's both helpful and not helpful at the same time. Because if you're trying to onboard a customer and they need it right this second, then it kind of puts a cap on how much the urgency impacts the total score. And we'll get through the other three factors here. But once you go through these, there's a calculation that you put on these based on the numbers that you assign. And that comes out to a score for this particular task. It makes it easy to relate it to the other tasks. Do you think it's important to have a score in there for urgency with a deadline that's less than 3 months?
I do, although, so here's the thing. It depends on what time horizons you look out at, right? I think in your early days, like where Blue Tick is, I think you should probably have no deadline, 2 months and 1 month, or no deadline, 1 month and 2 weeks, because your timelines are so much more critical, right? Because you need to move way faster right now to try to get to product market fit as soon as possible. I think as a product matures and the team grows, this could feasibly get longer. Even now with Drip, we don't really, I'm thinking and looking ahead 6 months, 9 months, but I'm not actually planning. I just have ideas of what we're going to build. So to me, the 0, 3, and 6 month is a little too broad for us. I would probably have 0, 1, and 2 or 0, 1, and 3 months. We typically plan fairly tight. We plan about 60 to 90 days out because I find that so much changes by the time you get there. New priorities come up, new feature ideas come up. Competitors do things, and you know, you have performance issues that suddenly you need to turn your head and try to scale. And so there's a lot that can change in, you know, 90 days in the life of a startup. So I would just compress this, but the gestalt of what he's saying here is still the same.
Yeah, and that's something else to kind of point to as a side note, is that even though some of these things are written down in such a way that there are those raw numbers of like 6 months and 3 months, feel free to change those things. I mean, make whatever the framework you use fit into what it is that you're actually doing, because Anthony's business is much further along than Blue Tick, for example. So not everything that he has in here is going to directly apply to what I'm doing, but that doesn't mean that you can't make some changes or modifications that will help it fit your situation better. So if you look at it and it doesn't quite fit what you're doing, feel free to make those changes, especially if it's going to fit what you're doing. The third criteria in here is the impact. And what the impact is that it's a value that indicates the potential impact on profitability. And this is rated anywhere from -2 to +2. And -2 is a significant negative impact. 0 is little to no impact. And then 2 is a significant impact. And I really like this because there are some things that you are going to do which will probably have a negative impact on your profitability. They may make things worse for you. And then there's other things where if you do that, let's say you make a pricing change and you increase prices, that can have a huge impact. And it's just when you start adding those things in, it allows this to adjust the priority up or down based on what those numbers come out to.
Yeah. You know what I like about this is oftentimes when we're talking about what features to build, I will ask, you know, whoever we're talking to, typically it's Derek or someone else on the team, and I'll say, will this help us retain more customers, meaning keep them from canceling, or will this get us new customers in essence? Is it a marketable thing that new people will sign up for? And that's what, in essence, Anthony's encapsulating with this impact score. And I like how simple it is, and I like that it kind of combines all of that into a single number.
The fourth one is a risk factor, and this is an indication of what is going to happen if this is not implemented. And this is a very simple rating, 0 to 2, which is 0 is little to no risk, 1 is some risk, and 2 is a significant risk. And this risk factor could be a bunch of different things. So for example, if there's paperwork that you need to file with the government, for example, then if you don't do it, then you know you could go out of business, especially if it's like a lawsuit that you have to respond to. And then there's other things where it's a feature that somebody had asked for. Is it really going to make a huge difference to you if you don't put, you know, like hover text over a button, for example? Probably not. Does it help the application? Does it make the user experience better? Yes. But is it risky to not do it? And the answer in that case is obviously no.
Yeah, I also think of stuff like scaling, right? I mean, there's a risk factor of like, do we need to upgrade the database server, right? Or do we need to optimize the piece of code to make it 5 times faster? And it's like, well, there, you know, maybe these, all the other ones before, like the impact will be really kind of zero, right? It's no impact to customers. The urgency, well, I mean, you know, it could be the next 3 months, but as soon as you introduce a risk factor of like, if we don't do this, we risk slowing down, we risk performance issues, we risk, you know, upsetting people. I think that's a nice piece that this captures.
Or you risk, your, you know, like some sort of security settings, like, hey, we need to make some sort of a structural change in the database. And if we don't do this, then there's a risk that customer data could leak from one customer into another. So that's another way that risk can kind of fall into it. The last one that he has here is innovation. And this is a indicator of what type of influence that the task has on your long-term growth. And so this is rated from 0 to 2, and it's 0 is little to none. 1 is, it says, ahead of the curve, and then a 2 is groundbreaking. And I'll be honest, like, I wasn't real fond of the term innovation. So I forget what I put it on my spreadsheet, but I had changed that to essentially say, like, how is this going to impact long-term growth? I think that's actually what I called it, was long-term growth opportunity. And this is, you know, it's very nice to be able to relate that back and say, yeah, this is not going to make any difference, or it's going to make a huge difference. And I think you can also consider this in relation to what your competitors are doing and what your long-term vision for the product looks like. If this is going to open up new doors for you to go into a completely new market, then that would be either 1 or 2. But if it doesn't do any of that, then it's probably a 0.
Yeah, I think a lot of things would be a 0, kind of the day-to-day of like, I need to add these settings, I need to add this screen, I need to, you know, you think about merging subscribers and drip, like I talked about earlier. Is that really innovative? I mean, to be honest, it is 1, it's ahead of the curve, because most apps don't have it, but it's not like groundbreaking, right? Like when workflows or something like that really jumped us ahead. So I can see where this applies. I'm wondering, I don't necessarily think of it in terms of innovation. I typically think of it in terms of impact. So, you know, once we get down and see the multipliers, I want to see how innovation plays against impact, because I could see removing innovation altogether, because most of the time I don't want to innovate unless it has a major impact. Does that make sense? Like,
It does, but remember, the third one on this list was impact. So that's why I went through and started changing some of these names.
Right. Well, I was going to say, that's where, like, I'm only going to build an innovative thing if the impact is high. So I'm not sure why I also need to say it's innovative, because the impact is going to be high and the innovation is going to be high. You know, it's almost like, to me, innovation tracks with impact. If all these go together, like in the same direction, they're correlated, then there's no reason to have them. You should just have one number, right? The only reason that you should have all 5 of these is if they go in different directions based on what you're building. And so that's what I'm still trying to get my head around, is how impact and innovation, I think, are different.
And that's why I said that I played around with the terms when I put them in my spreadsheet, because the difference between impact and innovation was not very clear. What I did was I basically said, I changed impact to say short-term profitability impact, and then innovation was long-term growth impact.
Oh, nice. Okay, that's cool. I like that, actually.
Yeah, it separates out, like, hey, you need to do this. And it's more the profitability impact is like, what's the direct result that's going to be short term for us in terms of financials? And then the long term innovation is like the long term growth. What is this going to look like for us 6 months, 12 months down the road? We may do something that doesn't really change anything now, but what would be the impact of that in 12 months? And if it's something small in the UI, very little innovation associated with it. But something like it with drip workflows, it's probably going to have a small impact now, but 12 months down the road, 18 months down the road, it's huge, because it gives you so many more things to do.
So now that we have, you know, you have a spreadsheet, you put down all of your scores for all of your different feature ideas, or even if they're not features, it's just development, you know, ticket ideas, basically. How do we score these things?
So the calculation that he has is you take each of these things and you multiply them by different numbers and you add or subtract them based on what they are. So the impact and urgency, you multiply each of them by 3 and add it to get the score. The risk factor, you multiply by 4. And then the innovation, you multiply by 2, and you add those numbers together, and then you subtract the effort times 3. So the larger something is, and remember that effort can go up to, it can either be 1, 2, or 3. So you're going to be subtracting either 3, 6, or 9 from your final score. So something might be like very risky if you don't do it now, and it could have a huge impact. But if the effort is large, it can really reduce the score associated with that. And I actually found when I went through this a couple couple of months ago when Anthony had first posted this in Founder Cafe, was that there were things that I felt were much more important. And then looking at the score that came out of it, which he calls priority, but I like to call it score just because it's a numerical calculation. It's very easy to look at those scores and just sort by that score and see relative to each thing, like what is really important to the business and what's not. And I found there were things that rated up there as like 15 or 17. And then there were things that I thought were more important and they only rated like 9 or 10. And I felt like there was a dividing line between things that were less than a score of 10 and things that were more. Like those things that were more than 10 really felt like they were truly important.
Yeah, I think this can be a really nice kind of guide to help you not just make gut feeling decisions. And, you know, I don't know that I would go directly down these in priority order and build in that order, but I think it can give you a really nice framework, or I guess guide is the best way to be. You know, maybe if something was a 5, I might make it more than a 7 or higher priority than a 7, because I know of something that's maybe not captured in just these numbers or in the multipliers or whatever. But that aside, I actually, you know, as you look through these, it seems like all the bases are covered. And if you put accurate numbers in each of these and you multiply out the score, I think there's a lot of value in doing that.
Yeah, I actually thought about that because I was looking at the things that scored lower than I thought they should. And I really tried to go back through the different columns and say, you know, is this score justified? You know, should this be more urgent? Should it have a larger impact? And I could make some variances here and there, but realistically, when I started looking at everything together and scoring them in the same way, I really couldn't forcibly take that score any higher. And it's not to say that you can't prioritize starting something in advance, because obviously, like if something's a large scale project that's going to take you 3 or 4 months to complete, you have to remember it's going to take 3 or 4 months to complete. And you may have to start it now. And in parallel, you do other things, but you're not going to be able to start it today and be finished with it tomorrow. That's just not going to happen. So you do have to take that into account when planning. But I think that it does help you in terms of deciding objectively what you should start planning to do versus the things that fall much lower on the list that just aren't as important as you thought they were. And maybe you put them on the list and assign them to somebody and they actually don't need to be done.
Yeah, I think this could be helpful for you know, when you're getting started as a kind of a product owner. If you just have so much stuff on your plate that it's hard to decide and you kind of need a guide, I really, you know, think that there's some value here. So if you want to dig into that a little more, we will link that up in the show notes. It's on blog.dnsimple.com. And thanks to Anthony Eden for sharing that with the Founder Cafe community and now the Startups for the Rest of Us community. If you have a question for us, call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from our Out of Control by Moot. It's used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups and visit startupsfortherestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.